Hi, this is John Beaner, and this talk is done by a gentleman by the name of Pat Kelly. He was one of the founders of a company called Physician Sales and Service. Right now, that's a $2 billion company, and they actually deliver medical products to physicians, to their offices, and really have a worldwide presence at this point in time. Pat Kelly, in this, we titled this, by the way, Developing Key Leadership, and there's a lot of ideas, things that he's used a lot through the tech experience where I had worked with him for about 8 years, one-on-one, and leading the group that he was involved with, a group that I was involved with for, or an organization I was involved with for 13 years and had the license for the state of Florida. But Pat is an individual who is coming from this from a secular point of view, because that's his experience level. But there's a lot of practical ideas here, and a lot about innovation, and a lot about risk-taking and the things that he did. I mean, when Pat joined the group that we had him involved with, it wasn't easy to get him in the group because the average company size was probably 50 to 60 million in sales, and he was doing about 2 million in his company that he'd co-founded with two other guys. But he was very hungry, and he was very excited about growing the company. In fact, I remember when I first sat down with him, he told me his goal was to get to $500 million, you know, within the next 10 years. Well, he even surpassed that, actually, several times over. But he learned so much through that experience, a small group, interchange, resources. You'll probably hear some of that in this talk, but he is a unique individual and a fun guy to know and to deal with. He's developing another business today that he hopes to take just as big as this one that he left years ago. But it's a good talk that I think you'll get good content from. So appreciate the opportunity to share this with you. And let's just turn it over and catch up with Pat as he's making some introductory remarks.
Thanks, John. Well, I appreciate an opportunity to be able to speak to you today, and hopefully we'll have some dialogue. Please ask questions as we go along. Take something back from this. Hopefully something can help you in your business, because it was in 1985 I joined tech, and I stayed with it through 1990. And literally, I watched our business grow. And in 1998, we had accomplished $1.7 billion in sales. And over that life of our company, still going today, it's approaching $2 billion in sales today. But from 1983 to 1998, in a 15-year span, you do the math, this company grew from $2 million, actually $1.7 million its first year in sales, and it accomplished $1.795 by 1998. That's a 43% annual growth rate. Wow. Now, when you're having that kind of growth rate for 15 years consistently, you go find out, yes, you can bury a lot of stumps, but you also create issues you never imagined before. It's part of the reason why I joined tech. I knew the company was going to grow fast. Yes, I had a big vision to grow something because we fell onto something that was really working, and there was a serious need in America for. Prior to PSS starting, a physician's office who bought product, whether it be syringes or table paper or gloves, would typically wait up to a week to get that product from their hospital distributor. And nursing offices just did not have staff. They did not have storage space. They needed product quickly. And there was not any company in America providing that. And in 1983, when we started this concept of giving quick delivery, back then we guaranteed next day delivery. Today we guarantee same day delivery. Any order placed by noon to our physician company is delivered that day within 100 miles of 59 locations. That touches about 85% of the doctor's offices in America. So when you have that type of regimentation, you go from zero to become the market leader. So we knew we were going to grow quick. We knew it was a big market. When John did sit down in 1985 and asked me how big I thought we would be, I told him we're going to grow a $500 million company. When I joined the first tech group, and you'll love this, there was, at that time, I think there were 11 in our tech group. Sitting next to me as we were going around the room introducing everybody themselves to me and me to them. And John said, Pat, tell them your goal. And I said, I actually had upped my goal after visiting with John. I said, I want to grow a $1 billion company. Everybody went in the room went, huh? And Dolores Kessler was sitting next to me on the left. And Dolores says, I like his goal. I'm going to do that too. And Dolores grew a billion-dollar company called Modus today. It's called AccuStaff prior to change of name. So both of us accomplished it. Well, what are the issues that you've got when you're growing a company very rapidly? It clearly came down to us, the issue of finding the talented people who can take the mission or your cause and be able to understand it, grasp it, and spread it. How do you find your disciples? We had to come up with a way to find our disciples to spread our business and grow. And actually, in the first 8 years of our existence, we grew internally. We did not grow by buying people. It was only after we got public and had the financial resources that we aggressively grow through acquisition. So when you're growing internally, you better find a talent pool and get people to grow and help you grow your business. So we had to start the basis of our company, what's called our leadership engine. And I wanted to go through that with you today of how we identified a talent in our company, how we gave them the resources, and how they were able to grow. Today, most of these folks are running $100 million divisions in our company quite successfully today. If I can figure out how to make this work. There we go. Yeah, first of all, we start with the basic premise in our company that you manage things, but you lead people. And the trap that we always fall in as managers is we try to come up with a concept that we got to manage what people do. No, you don't have to manage people. You got to lead people. That's what they expect from you. Give them the processes that you manage. And that's what we did in our organization. We identified if you're going to have a process of same-day service, manage that process. And the process is your trucks have got to roll consistently at 8 o'clock your first run. The next run has got to roll at 12:30. You got to build a model that puts the consistency in. Think about McDonald's, their process, or anybody, Home Depot, they got a process. You manage the process, but you lead people. Warren Bennis, if you ever want to pick up anybody who really understands and has studied consistently leadership and how to identify leadership skills, he is excellent at it. He typically, in his book on becoming a leader, differentiates what a leader and a manager is. And I don't need to go through each one of these, but it's real clear that a leader looks at ways of changing things, not in how to administer things. Leader clearly looks the long view. What is the ultimate goal of your organization? You must know that. And if you don't know that, you better be thinking it. Where do you see the end game? You can always hire the management tasks that are needed, but you must lead. How did we come up with the process at PSS? Well, first of all, we made some basic assumptions very early in our career that if you're going to build a leadership model, and by the way, still today, anybody who's in a management position in our company today does not have the term manager on their cards. They're called leaders. They're sales leaders, they're operation leaders, they're accounting leaders. There are no managers in our company. So from that standpoint, how do you develop a mindset among your people that they got to lead people and manage things? First of all, we've made some understandings of basic premises of our organization. First of all, encourage mistakes. Actually, reward mistakes. When people are doing something where for the first time it's being done, that it might not be ideally what you like them to do, but if they get results, isn't that all what you're interested in? So encourage mistakes. And we always did in our organization telling our folks, go ahead and make mistakes, because it comes down to our third premise. We tell them it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. And as John says, I would go around to each location at least twice a year, sit down with the leadership team, and clearly, before the meeting got started, they would all confess to their transgressions for this past year. Asking for forgiveness. Well, I really didn't quite get this done to what we'd like to get done. And in the reality, we're saying that's fine. Make mistakes. We talk about hiring CEOs, not truck drivers. All of our business cards of our 520 PSS truck drivers says CEO. Now, why did we do that? Well, it's funny, when I would go back in the back of our buildings and I'd walk around and talk with our warehouse employees, I'd ask them, who's the CEO? And they'd always screw up and say, well, you are. But the one who got smart and said, I am, is the one who got 20 bucks right on the spot. Why do we say that? Well, the founder of SAS Airlines, Jan Carlson, wrote a book, Moment of Truth. And he says, when you're standing in front of the customer, in the customer's eyes, who is the CEO? So we empower our people to make the decisions that they have to keep the customer satisfied. That's why I'd rather that truck driver, if asked to pick up a piece of equipment at that physician office, even though that sales rep just sold it, even though they signed the papers, might have even paid us for it, I told that truck driver, you pick it up if that's what the doctor wants. Because ultimately, long term, if we keep that doctor's business, we will be in business. You got to hire before the need. Who actually recruits for positions prior to actually needing that position? There's one, two. Well, imagine in our company today at PSS over here in South Point that they have today, just in the physician company, 50 trainees, 50 at all times. In a 14-week sales development program, they actually do not know where they're going to go sell. They don't know where they'll be. They're typically working around America in the warehouses, driving our trucks, taking their lessons. But for 14 weeks, they're actually sitting on a bench in the minor leagues waiting for an opportunity to occur. In the total organization, there are 120 sales trainees in the whole process of all three of our divisions. So we actually, last year, spent about $3.5 million to have this talent pool of people before we needed them. Well, with 1,250 sales reps actually in the marketplace every day, you know you're going to have turnover. They'll either go into a leadership role, they'll get married, they get pregnant, they leave. Whatever the reason, they decide that this is not what they want to do, we have turnover just like any other company. To us, it's fine. We have a bench, and that bench is always ready to go. We look for natural leaders, and we do sporting events. We played annually twice a year picnics, both regional and national picnics. We would play volleyball, competitive volleyball. We would want to see the leadership skills of our people, play softball. We want to see the natural leaders, people that want to get involved. And by the way, we had a lot of fun in the process. We're looking for behavior. We're not interested in experience. When we recruit, and Nate Eden commented about that off the college campuses, we recruited over 60 universities today. And as we go recruit, we're not interested in their resume. They don't have a job description. We're only interested in the behaviors. Are they looking to succeed? Are they looking to do what it takes to become successful? That's what we're looking for. And in the process, we coach and not manage. Let's say you're successful selling for us. And this is where why we had to start this leadership school. And we started in 1986. We were promoting very successful salespeople into a leadership role. And as quick as we were putting them out into the field, guess what we were doing? We're having to pull them back in. Because reality, we were experiencing about a 90% failure rate. The things it takes to be successful in sales will not make you successful in a leadership role. So that's why we had to change the parameters of what we were looking for and identify those talents that we need in those people to lead. And we'll talk a little bit about how we did it through the leadership process. But first of all, you had to be successful in sales. That got you in the door, got you an opportunity. You say, I want to go into a leadership role. I want to become a CEO. We say, great. Well, we'll go bring you in. We'll go do some testing on you. We'll go take some leadership reading so you really understand what you're getting into. And we're going to go a little bit through that. We'll go recognize the skill set of a leader is an ability to team problem solve. And we're going to walk you through that. We're going to see what your motivational skills, why you want to go into this particular role. And we're going to have the team assess you as you go through this leadership program. Did I tell them what? Huh? It's coming up. Well, the first thing is we say to them, okay, you want to become a leader. Are you really sure that's what you want to do in this company called PSS? Because understand the parameters of the rules. If you're a leader of an operation in El Paso or in Portland, Oregon, It doesn't matter. At any point in time, if the employees feel you're doing a poor job, they can pick up a telephone and call us and say, get this bum out of here. So understand, if you're going into a leadership role with us, you can be fired by your employees at any point in time. Now, why would we do something like that? Accountability to the people, what leadership is supposed to bring accountability to their employees. That's what it's all about. Well, a lot of them would say, oh boy, that isn't quite what I thought this is all about. And in many cases, a lot of them would say, this is not what I want. And that's fine. But why would they take on that assignment then, knowing they can be fired by their employees? How would you feel if your employees could fire you? Yes.
I would like it, but good question. Did you ever have that happen? How often did that happen when you sent somebody off and the employees fall back and said, get rid of this?
Actually, about 5 to 10 times a year. It happened a lot. More than you realize.
That's not much compared to your 90% failure rate.
Yep. Oh, no question about it.
At what point in their, when they basically first showed up, or any time throughout their...
Any time during their tenure. Because ultimately, our attitude was all along that the employee should be allowed to fire you, because ultimately they will. If they don't get results, you go get fired because you couldn't get results. And even if you get results, they can fire you by leaving. So either way, they're going to fire you one way or the other. So we made an environment where it was okay to get fired. Now, don't feel bad about the people who get fired, because we promised them if they ever did get fired, we would allow them to go back to at least what they were doing before. If you were selling for us, you can at least go back into a sales territory. If you were a purchasing agent, went into operations, you could go back. I couldn't guarantee you your territory. I couldn't guarantee you where you were going, but I guarantee you your job would be there, so it was worth taking the risk. Now, this is an interesting statistic that we did last year. Over 60% of the people who are running our organization today had been fired somewhere in their career by their first group of employees. And they learn from their mistakes.
That's good.
So that's the process. You create an environment. It's okay to fail. Just learn from that and become successful. We're going to test you. Now, we never campus. We never tested you to determine if you were smart or if you had sales aptitudes or any of those things when you were interviewing with us, because we know C students run the world, so we're not really caring very much about how well you do in school. But now that you're getting ready to go into a leadership role, we want you to understand that we understand everything there is to know about you. So we're now going to test you and measure you. So your first day here at leadership school in Jacksonville, we're going to spend a whole day doing nothing but putting you through a battery of tests. The three primary tests we're interested in is the first one is called our OPQ, and the next two are called the verbal and math skills. What is the OPQ? It's called Occupational Personality Questionnaire. We want to know, do you have the traits we're looking for? And we had a group here, Les Kruger. I don't know, John, if you know Les's group, but he came in and helped us develop this, and we still use this process today. We took 10 of our best leaders that we had in the company and brought them in and said, help us define the traits that you see in leadership, and we then measured those traits, and we want to find, are you a candidate to fit that profile for the traits? Explain the job, what it means, what you have to do, and then you measure up the personality traits to fit that. It could be different from being a banker, from being a sales leader. Our ops leaders have a different requirement than our sales leaders have. So each program is differently, and it's really geared toward the strengths of what that position requires. And this is a tip how we come back and judge. Now, what do you think the number one trait out of 60 personality traits ended up being? Anybody want to get our number one trait to be successful as a sales leader in our company? What trait do you think that had to be? Motivated, it was like number three. That was like up there. It was like number four or five. For a sales rep, it's number one. But for a sales leader, it's not that high. Got to be motivated. Got to be compassionate. That was up there. But our number one was democratic. democratic. Okay, as opposed to being autocratic. They don't want a boss. They wanted a process where the people could contribute to the process in helping make decisions. So we rated a person from 1 to 10. So you would think a 10 being democratic would be good, right? Right? I mean, if they got a 10, if you're rating 1 to 10, if you're looking for that trait, 10 must be good, but actually it's very bad. The average measurement on the traits we're looking for, anywhere in that 7 to 8% range. Because if a person who was rated a 10 on democratic, guess what would happen? They couldn't make decisions. When it ultimately came down to being make a decision and people couldn't come up with the solutions themselves, they weren't willing to. So what happens if you're rated a 10 for being competitive? Huh? I'm sorry? Yes. Well, ultimately what we found out, a person who's rated a 10 on competitive will do anything to get the deal. That's not good. So it actually, how this measured up, our candidate, certain range, they were competitive, but not so competitive they would do whatever it would take. So we wanted that 7 to 8 parameter, not a full 10 on how they were measured. It's a great process for understanding the skill set of what you're looking for. And keep in mind, we recognized we needed a whole bunch of these soldiers, so we had to go through a lot of people to find out these soldiers that had these candidates, that these attributes that we were looking for. Then the verbal and math skills. And it was so interesting, we put our now potential sales leaders through the process, very successful sales reps, very gung-ho type of individuals. They didn't necessarily do very well at the skill sets. But it never ruled them out from being a leader. We just wanted to understand, did they have the strengths and understanding of what they needed to do? So whether they needed decent verbal skills, but sales leadership didn't need to have great math skills. But their operation leader on the other side had to have very good math skills. We didn't care if he couldn't even speak the English language. So we didn't care about the verbal skills. So we were always trying to figure out, if we understood your strengths and weaknesses, we can always put you with a team member who has complementary skills. Because we always operated the leadership in our organization. There was no A leader in a branch of PSS World Medical. And today with 117 locations, each one of them has two leaders. A sales leader and an ops leader. So you use this testing to make sure you match your people accordingly so one strength offsets the other one's weaknesses. In leadership reading, this is, as John mentioned, we're going to take you half a day out on the boat and we're going to talk about what leadership is all about. We required some reading, and some of it's pretty deep reading here. Plato, Allegory of the Cave. I don't know if you remember that from college. But that goes back a long way. But Plato surely writing the prospects of what leadership is, the ability to bring people into the light, an explanation of the basic needs of what leaders are. To Dostoevsky, who wrote about the Spanish Inquisition. And needless to say, that wasn't great leadership that came about during that point in time, but he surely clearly dramatized that people don't want that type of management today. They want leaders who can help them see the light. So we would read all of these programs and we would talk about the different issues of what leadership and what they're all about. I've got one here. Who was that?
Jesus.
Oh. No doubt about it. Okay. But like here, this is one of the programs that they had to read about, one of the stories. Let you read it and somebody tell me, what is the moral of this story about leadership? A servant leader. A Gandhi approach to leadership is clearly the leadership model we were trying. The Jesus model of leadership is clearly the model that we were trying to build in our organization. And from that standpoint, that here you go, all of a sudden, this sales rep who's been so successful in sales, has probably been recognized a couple times at our national sales meetings, they've gotten awards, they've gotten plaques. All of a sudden, this rep has now got to go literally to change his view of the world of how he is going to interact with all of the people that he works with. And I can tell you that at this point in time, when 50% of these sales types show up here for this week's program, and when they finally out on that boat get a clear understanding of what a leadership model for us is going to be, by the end of the week, we're not having to ask them not to consider leadership. They're asking us, how do they get the next plane out of town? Because that's not their view. And that's why we were able real quickly to differentiate the needs and understanding. People thought when they showed up here that they were going into a leadership role, into a boss role. And boss just don't work at our company. Problem solving. Don't you think leaders got to be pretty good at solving problems? Do you, in your organization? Well, we thought so too. And it became a very good part of our business. And we had a couple different ways to approach and trying to get our people to understand the need to problem solve. And that's the role that leadership brings to our organization. And we did it through a game. It's called Friday Night the ER. It takes about a half a day. They play it in a setting like this while they're at the leadership school. And some interesting things come out during that actual playing of this game about how to problem solve. First thing is the ability to communicate. We clearly understanding and articulating. All of a sudden, you're in an ER setting on a Friday night, and everything that can go wrong in the city goes wrong. Who's been to see Pearl Harbor? Okay. Remember the hospital scene? Can you imagine that hospital scene that they're having to send the nurses outside. They're having the military police keeping people from coming in. Hospital with nobody in the beds to all of a sudden 3,000 patients, literally within minutes. And nurses are having to go outside, put lipstick on the foreheads of the people, trying to triage the people as who's going to live, who's going to die. Well, actually, in a issue of this ER, activity picks up and things start to happen. And the ability to problem solve is how they, first of all, start with how they're building a bridge of communication. And it brings them through the process on how to do that. Then we teach them a process of problem solving that you as a leader do not have to know the answers. It's okay that you don't know the answers. It's even better if you don't know the answers. It's best to let your people figure out the right answer. Y'all know who Ralph Steyer is? And Jim Belasco, they wrote a book, Teach Elephants to Dance, and a few other stories like that. But Ralph Steyer, who is the CEO of Johnsonville Foods, anybody from Wisconsin, they make great sausage and other hot dogs and things of that nature. He's so funny. I heard him once at Tech, and he was talking about his organization. And he said, it was interesting how they were trying to solve problems. He would go down and tell the people on the line how to fix it. And he built the quality control into his organization to try to make his meats better. He says the meats just got worse and worse. So he decided that they were going to start a process. And they told all the line workers that management now once a week, unannounced to them, would come down and actually taste the product to make sure it tasted okay. And he said that was the worst mistake they ever did, because now the meat got worse because they figured out everybody was trying to kill the management. So then they changed the principle of how to get people involved in solving their own, how to make a better product. And the people came up with solutions themselves that not the managers would do the testing, but they would do the testing. Anybody could stop the line at any point in time and be able to go stop the line, take some sausage off, go be able to cook it and make sure it was good. If it's not, they could come back, stop the line. Any employee could. He got the employees involved in solving the problem. He said within 3 years, their sales went from $20 million to $140 million in 3 years just by making a better product, getting the people involved in the process of what their problems were. It team builds. And ultimately, what you learn in problem solving and this exercise for them, when the patients are outflowing from the ER down the hall into the radiology department, into the lab, it's finally the team who wins is the ones who break the rules. Ultimately, doing what you have to do to make sure you take care of, ultimately, your customer. We then take them for half a day out to a challenge course. We go over to JU, and on this challenge course, they spend a day basically working as a team. Now, this is the last of the leadership school. And they're spending this time basically trying to solve problems as a team. Each one's appointing a leader for each task. some of a very daunting task. They must climb up about 80 feet and walk across a pole. They're supported, needless to say. I mean, if they fell off, they're not going to get hurt. But it's still psychologically, your mind is having to work double time. Can I do this? And most people say they can't. And at the end of the process, they do. And when they finish up, ultimately, the team will assess them, what kind of leaders they were, and rank them. So they're ranking themselves in a competitive mode over this last week, who provided the best leadership to us as individuals. So ultimately, this is how we came up with our leadership model that drove our business and made our company successful. But it didn't stop there. You were identified as a leader. Now we got to go the next step. You're in a leadership role. And we recognize it's an ongoing process. It never stops. That you must continue to learn. And so the next few things I'm going to go over are the things that we kept involving our people in throughout the year to make sure that their leadership skills continue to improve as well as their employee skills. The first one here is called Creativity Week. Been doing it for 12 years. Creativity Week is a unique process. They spend, before they come, about 3 weeks ahead reading basically 5 books. And then we talk about those books and how they interact in the decisions that they have to make as a leader at our locations. And that book is A Whack on the Side of the Head, which talks about how to innovate, get innovation into your company. It's a fun book to read, and it's also fun to talk about the different processes to make sure they're making their companies a fun place to be. The second one is The Goal. It talks about why they would want to set goals, why we set goals. And we have set 2 goals as a company, and we accomplished both of them. And they were pretty big, hairy, audacious goals. The first one was to be the first national physician supply company. We were a $10 million company in 1989 when we came up with that goal. And by 1994, we had accomplished that goal. We were the first company ever to be national in every zip code in America, selling exclusively to physicians. Our next goal in 1993, we were $150 million. We said we'd be a billion-dollar company by the year 2000. Well, we got there a little bit earlier. We got to $1.8 billion that year of 1998. Dennis Conner, the sailor who wrote The Art of Winning and the traits it takes to be successful in leadership. Peak Performance, Charlie Garfield's book. We talk about the leadership skills and, of course, the 7 basic habits of very effective people. So that morning, you can imagine a leadership program, it's about an 8-day program, but you're only in as a leader for 2 days of it. So the first day that you show up, we go through the readings that you read, and we talk about what they mean to you and how you interact with those readings in your business in the morning. The afternoon, we spent talking about problem solving and basically 25 mistakes we made as a company. We want you to understand and solve those using innovation, how you would do it better, and we're going to talk a little bit about that here in just a minute, how you would solve that problem. They do it as individuals, and then they talk about them as a team. The next day, we had 3 or 4 of the leaders in for that first day. The next day, another 3 or 4 come on. And the leader who was a student that first day now becomes a teacher the second day. They bring the next group through the writings of the books, what they mean and how they're impact their business and their decision. And then that afternoon, now the team of 8 who are on this leadership Creativity Week program are now solving another 25 problems. And it could be problems such as this. This is one of the case studies. We don't use real names, but I can tell you when you grow rapidly, you do a lot of dumb things. And you're trying to set some lessons in play with your people of how to make decisions. How would y'all solve this problem if it occurred to you as a new leader walking into an operation? Pat James, new sales leader coming into Buffalo. The first thing he asked for, customer service rep. Here's the customer service rep say, it's not my job. Okay. You're now in a leadership role. You're Pat. What are you going to do? What's your next move? What are you going to do? Okay. That's great.
She may take her along as you solve the problem, so she walks through the process with you.
Okay, that's great. Any others?
Ask if there's wild place you'd like to work.
Well, you might not want to.
I'm not democratic enough to say.
You might not want to kill her, because guess what? It might not be her problem. I mean, if I'm a sales leader walking into this environment, to me, I hear an employee say that, I would say, we got a prior leadership problem here. That this employee is not part of this team. She thinks that, you know, that this is her job and only her job. So we've got major issues. My first confrontation is going to be with the ops leader as to why does this lady think that something is not her job. And I'll probably be at war when it's over with that ops leader. And I can assure you that if that attitude doesn't change to permeate in that organization, that we're all here for one reason only, to serve the customer. And I don't care if we have to pull orders, if I have to drive a truck, I don't care what I have to do for this enterprise to be successful. Myself and everyone in it will do whatever it takes to be successful, to take care of the customer. If I can't ultimately convey that message, and I can tell you I was very good at conveying that message at PSS, because everybody understood that there is no job at PSS. It's a way of doing business, whatever it takes to keep customers. And that's why this company grew at 43% for 15 years, because you're not losing customers. See, most people and most businesses are losing customers out the back door as fast as they're pulling them in the front door. We didn't lose customers, and that's why we were able to grow the way we did. The leadership puzzle. Now, you might see we got a lot of tools that we use in our organization, and we talk a lot about leadership. I mean, and we had this program, an all-day leadership program. It was in Reno with our leadership team, and we talked about the four pillars of leadership. And they had to put these puzzles together basically like this, and they got awards and contests. The ones who could figure out how to put it together, answer the problems, how they brought value, and we called it the leadership puzzle PSS. But the four pillars are trust, confidence, passion, and perseverance. And if you can accomplish and execute on those strategies. But clearly, we walked through the process. Which one of those four do you think is the most important pillar? Which would be the first in your mind be successful in a leadership role?
Probably passion.
Trust. Ultimately. Passion, you got it. Yeah. With passion, you can get trust. But ultimately, trust was the most important element of how you build your organization. And that's the thing that we have to work the most on. Now, think about trust. And they got this partly through the leadership school when they came through. They show up as a new leader in an operation. And the first thing a new leader hears from every employee, the prior employee leader promised me, okay, X. All right, how do you handle that? I mean, this is a real moment of truth which will determine your level of how you build trust with this employee. What's important for you to do? Huh? Anybody want to take it on?
Well, obviously they had a reason for promising you that. Right. And I think that we certainly need to work together a while so that we can make sure we totally understand each other.
Right.
And if this is a possibility, then perhaps it should take place.
Yep. But it's a very defining moment as to how you go build your level of trust for your people. And in our organization, we simply said all along, even if we had a poor leader and a poor leader committed something to an employee, we as a company stand behind it. Because the trust was not with that leader. Who was the trust ultimately with? The company. The company. And so we defined and put that leader in a role, and sometimes it was painful. Sometimes to stand behind some commitments, it was painful. But ultimately, it ended up not being painful at all. And just like Nadine, twice in our history, we had to go to our employees, and we had 525 employees at the time. We had to ask the average employee to take a 30% cut in pay. It was a tough year, and we lost nobody. So you can be people, but only as Nadine said, when she across the board. When we found out that somebody had committed something, or if we found out that people were paying more, competitor, Taylor Medical, that was enticing our salespeople away by guaranteeing higher commissions. We changed our commission plan and gave them better service. We didn't lose anymore. And ultimately, in 1995, we bought Taylor. A branch board of directors. This is something that we started that's ended up being pretty new. Especially when you get real big like we were with 5,000 employees, you can have a message here, and how do you get the message down? More important to make up a branch board of directors. And they have, once a year, there are 9 members who run this board at each one of our 117 locations. There are typically 2 truck drivers on each board. There are 2 warehouse employees, 2 customer service employees, 2 sales reps, and 1 leader. The truck drivers elect their 2 truck drivers who are going to sit on the board. These board members are going to be paid. They're not paid a lot of money. They're paid $50 for every meeting they come to. So, but they're paid something for coming and participating and bringing their problems. And they then talk about their P&Ls. They go over a monthly P&L. We were an open book company before anybody knew what open book was. And so we started it very early in 1983 when we made a decision, our first banking crisis. And who here has had a banking crisis? Okay, everybody, of course. And we had 5, and I still got one of them buried in my backyard, Barnett Bank. Got a coffin in my backyard with my Barnett Bank mugs, and my legal documents are still down there. And that's a great story, and John and Nadine heard this before. But when we finally lost that bank for the second go-round, and we decided to celebrate. We had a coffin built. We had a grave dug in my backyard, and I lived on the St. John's River. And so that day we had all the employees. We shut the office down early in the afternoon to come to the funeral. To Robbie Barnett is what we called it. Robbie Barnett had a tombstone built and was put to rest in my backyard.
That's a heartwarming story.
The board meets with all the employees at the branch level, and this is the open book approach that we got started in very early. And they meet with once a quarter and share basically how they're doing on earning the bonus, and they pay it out twice a year. So our better branches, the typical employee, if you're a truck driver, makes about $18,000 a year. They make about another $12,000 a year in just bonus. So, and the last count, about 75% of our branches were in the bonus dollars consistently year in and year out. But they can only do that if they understand what are the things that drive their numbers and how to be successful. Now, once we became a public company, it was tough to be an open book company at the total corporation level, but it never changed our being open with each of the field operations. So each one of them knew all the time how they stood on making their money and what it would take to make them successful. So anyway, that's our leadership model of how we built PSS World Medical into a major leader, and today the First National Physician Supply Company. So I'll be glad to take any questions that you might have. We had, basically, we had to look at it 3 ways. I mean, overall go that our actual turnover of sales reps was about 20%. But actually, we had about a 35% turnover of our reps while they were in the training program. So we wanted to wash them out before we actually put them on the street. And our goal is consistently about 30% that we wanted to wash out. And it ended up about 35% it washed out. So, and the reason why is these folks had to put in 70 to 80 hour work weeks. They were driving their trucks. They were making long hauls. They had to do studies on the internet at night. They had to be passing their exams. They took a weekly exam on the product knowledge. They had to study about another 30 hours a week or they wouldn't pass. And our score was if you didn't have 80, you weren't passing. So, we wanted to be very selective and make sure that you understood, number one, a strong work ethic is going to make you successful, and 2, your willingness to apply yourself by learning. So 35% typically have washed out at that level. The next level is we're going to put you in a territory, and it's a 15-month salary to commission conversion program. So for the first month or two, you're on a salary, you're getting a little bit of bonus. But about the sixth or seventh month, your salary is starting to go down. Your commissions are growing. That if you aren't growing your business, your paychecks are going down. And so that process was to weed you out. If you couldn't grow at a level that we expected, you shouldn't be in sales. And so we lost about another 20% there. But once we got a rep out to over 3 years, who's been in a territory over 3 years, and take away what we lost to leadership, the ones who wanted to come into leadership, our turnover was less than 3%. So very small turnover. And the average rep for us right now makes $124,000 a year.
Patrick, it's well known y'all grew by a great number of acquisitions. How did the acquisitions, as far as blending in those acquired companies into your process? I know when you're going, you know, global as you have, had to be a lot of problems. Is it hard getting acquiring companies and bringing them into your process?
We never had any problem till 1998 because our acquisitions were small. But in 1998, when we bought Gulf South, is really when this company started to have major difficulties. And it was not driven only from the standpoint of there were accounting issues by a big five accounting firm with that company, but then there became environmental issues, reimbursements changed. PSS World Medical last year, if you talk about a recession, PSS World Medical last year wrote off $57 million of uncollected receivables. 40% of our customer base in the nursing home sector filed bankruptcy last year. So you had environmental issues that became pretty tough to overcome. But when the acquisitions were small, we spent the resources to make sure we could integrate them in. Where we got in trouble were the big ones, primarily one.
Do you think acquisitions for y'all were accomplish your sales growth, but as far as profitability, there's a lot of times you see an acquisition, but it's hard to get it to come to the bottom line?
Well, it depends. In PSS, in the physician company, any acquisition was really accretive right out of the gates because we simply would fold that operation into ours and take their building down, their sales force comes over. We immediately got instant profitability out of it. That wasn't the problem. It's when we jumped into other sectors that got us in trouble. Primarily the nursing home sector and the environmental issues around that nursing home sector.
But that large acquisition, was the problem a cultural issue, or was it just because they had a large segment of their business was from nursing homes, and what happened to the nursing homes and the legal cases, that would really
that's it was not a question of, yeah, they needed an upgraded sales force, but we had the ability to do that. We had the ability on the system side of re-engineering their delivery platform. Because they had come together through a lot of acquisitions who did not standardize. The beautiful thing about PSS and why it's sort of a profit machine today, the physician company, is that whether you're doing business in Jacksonville or you're doing business in Amarillo, it's exactly the same. I mean, the same trucks, the same computer systems, the same way of delivery, the same uniforms on the drivers, the same behavior. It's same all over. But when we acquired Gulf South, they were a confederation of companies, and they hadn't even standardized on a central computer platform. So we had to do all that. And so in the process of doing it, and we felt we could, in the process of doing that, we then recognized we had some accounting issues from those acquisitions. Then the government passed the prospective pay bill, changed reimbursements in 1998, and it drove the bankruptcies that were 40% of our customer base over there filed bankrupt. And we were an unsecured lender. So we got nailed.
What's the high and low of your stock over the last 6 months, and what is it now?
$2 to $7 over the last year, but ask over the last 3 years. It was $26 at the time of the acquisition of Gulf South, and it went as low as 2.25. So it's right now about 5, a little over 5. But it will recover because the basis of the business is still strong, and no more bankruptcies are being filed at Gulf South, so it's going to recover. And it's going to go back ahead. So, yes?
What were the key steps that you took to go from $1.5 million to $500 in sales?
It's a true great story. The company was founded by myself, Bill Rydell, and Clyde Young. For all types, marketing types. And when we got to that critical stage of growing from that second year, Bill and I and Clyde all sat down saying, we can get it in the door, but can't figure out how to make money. And so I said, we're going to have to step outside to bring in the fourth person. But he's not a founder. I know the person that we want. His name ended up being Jimmy West. I said, I know that we can get Jimmy, but it's going to be a tough decision, and then we'll tell you guys why. We were at that time, I think, we weren't paying ourselves much. I think I was making $70,000. So Jimmy's going to cost us $120,000. Bill and Clyde were making $50,000 or $60,000, I was making $70,000. And all of a sudden, we're going to go get somebody who could make money, but we're going to have to pay him $120,000. And when they agreed that we had to do something, so it was a question of really making that jump, make that investment, hiring somebody that you know you go pay more than what you're presently making. But if we didn't get that stabilized where we were consistently making money, collecting our receivables, controlling our assets, we knew we'd never grow the business. And we did. And I was proud of all three of us in making that decision. And I always tell the story about Jimmy. He held me up, and I had to pay him $120,000 when I was making $70,000. And it was about 5 years later when I was making about $300,000, he was still making $120,000. But Jimmy ended up, he is so good and so smart. He retired that year. Our stock was at $26 and sold it all. Huh? Our operations guy came in as our operations guy. Yes. Oh, we have. We've actually filled up that whole building there in South Point now. We've shut down all the operations other than customer service and purchasing operations from all the companies. They have moved to Jacksonville.
I know that gets rumors of moving the accounts receivables and so forth from the branch levels to a local area here in Jacksonville.
It's been very successful for us for doing that for DI and Gulf South. So, yes, we're definitely talking about doing it at PSS. Whether or not it becomes reality, because I'm not sure as talk about it, but we're not sure we're going to save anything because they do such a good job. PSS is just like printing out, it's just like the Treasury. Yeah. It's just printing out money. It had difficulties because it had an Abbott recall this past year. So it had a down year only because the largest product recall ever in the history of our industry occurred, and we're their primary vendor. But they've got those products straightened out now. I've seen those cards before, top 20. And threw it in the dumpster. Yes. Yes. Done that many a time. About six times I've done that. Because we have an open door policy, and we tell our leaders, if you've got to have a discussion, I encourage you, if you've got to have a discussion, every time you go behind your doors and close your door for a discussion, your employees are sure that it's this trust thing again, that you're talking about them. So we said, if you're going to have a management confrontation with somebody, take them to lunch. Take them off site. Go get a cup of coffee. Don't do it in front of your office. And literally, you go to our corporate office today, there are no closed doors. They're not allowed. And we encourage the employees of our company, if they had a leader who kept closing their door, they could at any point in time go take the door off the hinges and throw the door in the garbage dump. So, yes. It's interesting. I've looked at several projects and came very close to getting in the marble and granite business. I was approached by an Irish company that owns a quarry in Ireland, and they approached me to consolidate that industry here, and I did a lot of due diligence and research on it and ultimately decided that I didn't want to get in that business. Right now, I'm looking at two projects. It's a tough environment in trying to raise capital, as I'm sure you're aware. But we right now have got two business plans on the street trying to raise quite substantial dollars, one of them $25 million and the other one $20 million. One of them is to provide elective surgery financing for patients, whether they're going to have braces put in or facials or anything of that nature. The other company is to take advantage of a bill that was passed in November, signed by Bill Clinton, went into effect in April, called the Safety Needle Stick Act. Today, in America, there's 600,000 indirect sticks from needles by healthcare workers. As of any company that produces a syringe or scalpel or anything that where a healthcare worker can get stuck, is going to be penalized up to $50,000 per occurrence. There is not enough product in the marketplace to satisfy the needs. Typical legislation was passed, and today to buy a typical syringe is about cost of provider, a doctor, like 10 cents. The only products in the marketplace cost around 70 cents. And I've been approached by some Taiwanese to, they believe they can build product that we can sell in the range around 15 to 18 cents. So we're now trying to raise some money to mutually build a plant between American company and Taiwanese company, and of all places, Vancouver, and start bringing these safety products in. So I'm not sure which one will get off the ground. It's, like I said, pretty tough environment to raise capital today. But we'll go try them. Right. Becton Dickinson has been slammed pretty hard because of they haven't been able, but a lot of it is that legislation moves so quick. It's just like the legislative act that changed the reimbursement in the nursing home just blew through Congress so quick, so fast, got signed into law. Nobody understood the impact. I know we sure didn't, but it devastated 40% of nursing homes in America had to file bankruptcy after that change. And the same thing, you know, legislation changed pretty quick. And in this case, they couldn't react to it, and nobody's been able to react to it. But that creates an opportunity for us. So if we can get that done. Yes?
Pat, if you had to change anything, not necessarily business-wise, what would you do again? How would you do it differently? I'm not talking about the... doesn't have to be the, what was the acquisition, but you know, in your life.
Actually, nothing. I'm a Yogi Bear fan. You know, when he says come to a fork in the road, take it. you don't know where it's going to lead. I mean, people always ask me, do you really regret Gulf South? And yeah, it was unfortunate for our company that it really diminished the value of our company because of the issues that surrounded that company. But when they look at the company 5 years from now, nobody's going to remember Gulf South. And they will still remember this company, and the stock value will come back because it's a company built on basic principles of customer service, employee involvement, and it will come back and it will recover. And those issues are now getting behind it. So people aren't going to remember that. So, and I was ready, in all honesty, I was the correct leader to grow a business at 40% a year. But when it started dealing with the other issues, I wasn't happy. I wasn't having fun because I'm an entrepreneur. And I'm a lot better at entrepreneuring and motivating people than trying to manage through conflict and issues. So myself and the board mutually felt I wasn't bringing any value. So I wanted some time off, and then I will go charge ahead again. Any other thoughts? Yes, ma'am. Yes. Well, they knew they were coming, and it was so great that they knew they were coming to the program. They had 3 to 4 weeks to read the books prior to the program. They had heard from the other people who had been through the process. They knew they were going to sit down with me. I was there at every one of these programs, and it was my point of contact with that leader, whether a new leader, to really get to know them. These meetings were typically held at my house. And so they would spend time, so I got to know them individually. Actually, it was about 60 to 80 who came through the program, but keep in mind they came in groups of 8 at a time over a 2-day process. So I would end up with about a 10-day program, okay, to get them through the process. And be myself and another one or two senior officers of the company. And I would float around to spend time with each one. So they knew that they were going to be grilled. Now, there are a lot of our people who are not very good at reading, or not have a desire, but they'd go buy the tapes. We provide the books to them, but they could always go buy the tapes. And they typically came prepared. We would send them tests. They would get 1 week a book, and then the next week they get a test and another book. So they had a week to read each one of the books. And they got through it. Now, some of them would show up, having not read the books, and we'd grill them. I mean, we'd grill them. And so go back, and then they'd hear the stories. You want to read the books. No, I didn't. No, their peer group did. Oh, yeah, the peer group. The ones who went to the trouble to read would tell the ones who didn't, you know, you're not really helping contribute much here. Yeah. So, yes.
On your testings, aptitude testings and various tests you used, did you develop all of those yourselves in-house, or did you?
No, we went outside.
Went outside?
Yes. Yeah. Everything that, you know, I've said this many a tech group, and we didn't invent anything. We stole everything.
Good.
And I think a successful person can see, and now we would see it and say it has applications for us, and then defined it our way.
Sure.
To make sure that we would get across what we want to get across. But no, we didn't originate an original idea. I was in tech 5 years. I never missed a meeting. John Black. One of the few who never missed a meeting, but it was getting tough for me, you know, because we were then national, and that's why I had to step out of the organization.
How many miles you logged 1 year?
Last year, in year 2000, I was 406 hours on hourly, so that's about 240,000 miles, and 125 on. So I don't miss that. I don't miss that. Not at all.
You want to tell them about being a kid?
What about it? I was a kid. I was raised at the Virginia Home for Boys, and I was placed when I was five. My mother deserted our family. I have an older brother and sister. My brother was placed there. I was too young to be placed there. I was moved between aunt and uncle, up until I was 5 years of age. And five, I was placed at the Virginia Home for Boys. It's the second oldest orphanage in America behind Bethesda up in Savannah. So it's been around a long time. And I end up today hold the record of being the kid who lived there the longest. So that was my background. But I think it was a great background. I love the home. I have an organization that supports children's homes. We support so-called Safe Harbor. And if you haven't been out there or seen that organization, it's a Christian organization, and they do a lot of good for troubled boys. That's a great organization. We financially support it, as well as other homes. Today, if you're a kid at the Virginia Home for Boys and you stay and finish high school, I guess college scholarship. I paid for 7 kids to college last year. So, and they're all staying in. They're all doing well. I had one actually graduate from University of Richmond, Jepson Leadership School, and just got a job with Eli Lilly. And it's great to get that kid out of school. So that was an expensive school. But, but anyway. Well, thanks for letting me come. And I enjoyed the ability to talk with y'all.
Thanks for listening to this audio presentation. You know, we have a heart at Wise Counsel to serve entrepreneurs of faith, to help them understand their calling and purpose. That means being in the world still like everybody else. That means we got to do that effectively at a higher purpose and a higher calling if we call ourselves Christians. But we're not to be of the world. We're to be of God's leading. And that's not easy to always discern and understand. And that's part of our calling with you and helping you. Again, our key products and services are Ask Wise Counsel and that particular site. Again, you probably found us there with our audio and video materials that are available, as well as Genesis, the Business Workshop, which is 13 videos, a workshop series that can be done in a coaching process, done in a workshop, in-house companies, done in public sessions. You're welcome to go to our site on that. Wise Counsel Groups, we do, where entrepreneurs exchange ideas and give each other advice and counsel. It's a powerful process that we facilitate, a very professional. And then finally, Ask God About My Business, where we interview a series of outstanding Christian examples, business people, ministry people, who were questions have been submitted to us that we turn back to them, and if they were God in God's position, how would they answer that? If you want to contact us, you can contact me at john@askwisecounsel.com or just call us at 904-332-0425. Again, thanks for the opportunity to serve you.